Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Hillel Halkin, renowned translator, author, and man of letters, discussing the B'nai Menashe Jews of India. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I started teaching Talmud in my confirmation class last Sunday, and it struck me that this kind of thinking isn't something most high school juniors and seniors are used to doing in America. Nor is anyone else used to thinking that way, except perhaps in the Orthodox world. The Babylonian Talmud is at the core of Jewish law, halakha, and of all Rabbinic Judaism. And today, all movements in Judaism are descended from Rabbinic Judaism. I don't care whether they are Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Renewal, or Federation Secularists. All Jews today are coming from a form of Judaism forged by the Talmud. The Talmud's a way of thinking about the world, really, by inspecting and arguing about it from almost every angle, trying to see what God would want from us in every area of life. If you've ever tried to follow a Talmudic argument, then you know that it begins usually with a commandment from the Torah, a mitzvah, or at least a statement from the Torah of some kind, or perhaps a statement of law from an ancient Jewish authority that is derived from the Torah, or supplements or clarifies a commandment in the Torah. And then a whole slew of various authorities weigh in on just what is meant and how it should be applied. Usually they come to some reasonably clear decision about the issue, but not always. Since this is a Jewish process of determining the appropriate way to apply law, there is a great deal of arguing back and forth across the generations. Want to know how many times to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? You will find many opinions explored in depth in the Talmud, plus a number of stories about the shofar and some random tales about the rabbis who are discussing the question. There's something quite beautiful about the careful but free way the great scholars of the ages explore the meaning, implications, and balance between various legal, personal, communal, and even national needs in making decisions on everything from how to pray, to how to cook, to how to get married or divorced, or how to properly repent from sin or honor a parent. But although these were extraordinarily learned scholars and also very opinionated people, sometimes even they could not resolve a difficult Talmudic problem. Occasionally, in an act of quite beautiful and unusual humility, they will use a most interesting, even peculiar word, an abbreviation, actually. When they can't answer a question after an exhaustive effort to do so, they will say teku. That word, teku, stands for four Hebrew words that mean essentially, when the Messiah comes, Elijah the prophet will solve all the remaining problems and questions. It's a way of saying, no matter how smart we are and how much we know about Torah and law and reasoning, no matter how carefully we've constructed our arguments or arranged our proofs, these challenges we cannot solve. Only God can do it, eventually, we hope and pray. Until then, we must admit our failure and accept our limitations. And then the rabbis move on to a different problem that they almost always can solve. Wouldn't it be an amazing thing to hear from, say, the President of the United States from time to time? I tried, but I can't solve this. It's nobody's fault. I'm just not smart enough. I give up trying to control this thing I can't control and leave it in the realm of the Almighty. Teku. This problem is beyond us right now. We tried very, very hard to solve it, but, We'll have to leave it in God's hands for the present. Maybe when the Messiah shows up, we'll get our answer. In the meantime, we'll follow the best advice from the best qualified people, hope it works, and stop trying to pretend we know better than we actually do. Imagine how much better our national response to the COVID-19 pandemic would have been if back in March we had simply followed the CDC's and the NIH's recommendations, worn masks, socially distanced, shut down public gatherings for real until we got a handle on the coronavirus. We might be like the countries in Europe now, which had a very serious problem, addressed it very seriously, and now are returning to normalcy to a large degree, and which won't let any Americans in because our country didn't do that, and we have the world's highest infection rate and the greatest number of deaths. What if our own national political leaders had said, Teku, we can't solve this politically. Let's just do the best we can to protect people. Take our initial economic lumps, and then maybe we'll be able to go on with life down the road. I'm pretty sure that this Teku idea also has a place in our own daily lives. Probably an even bigger place. Because sometimes we encounter problems or layers of complexity that are genuinely beyond our abilities to solve them, no matter how hard we try to do so. We should, of course, try to fix everything we reasonably can, perform our own individual and collective versions of Tikkun Olam. But we also need to know when something is beyond us. Let it go. Move on to solving the things we can solve. An important message indeed in this month of Elul, this season of return and repentance. During this strangest year of all, this time of pandemic and isolation and absence, let the impossible go. Teku, work on what you can fix in your life. Do what you can. Leave the rest to God. Not a bad lesson right now, or at any time. To play us in this morning is a preview of the coming High Holy Days. Here's a medley of our Reshet Sfateinu melodies from the Rosh Hashanah Shofar service, coming up about 3 weeks from right now.
Rotomir, 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 Rotomir,
That was Cantor's Barry Braun and Ezra Sher singing Areshet Svatenu in a medley for the coming holiday of Rosh Hashanah, 3 weeks or so away. When we return in a moment on to Jewish, our guest, Hillel Halkin, one of the great translators of Hebrew into English, a fine author and a man of letters, will discuss the ongoing crisis with the B'nai Menashe, the Jews of India, whom he wrote about memorably in his book Jews of the Sabbath River. Meet Hillel Halkin when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson of the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. The High Holy Days are coming up fast. Join Beit Simcha for our blended online and very limited live seating for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Call 520-276-5675 or email rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. And don't miss our live drive-in second night celebration, September 19th, Saturday night. Music, shofar, and much, much more, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our synagogue's located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus sorus, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. We'll be holding services with full music virtually every week for the time being. Our Adult Education Academy classes, an extensive array of them, are on Zoom. You can access by emailing us at beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogue's located at 2270 West Ina Road, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in it, but in our own building. You can email us, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, or go to our website for more information about Beit Simcha, to attend services, the High Holy Days, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, and the High Holy Days and our second night drive-in celebration at the Gaslight Theater North. Go to beitsimchatucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish community in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Hillel Halkin is one of the most distinguished Jewish men of letters alive, I think. He is an outstanding translator, author, and in this case, advocate. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi Cohen. I like the way you stress the word alive.
Always a good thing. Good way to start the day and finish it, actually. I want to talk a little bit today in particular about the people that you chronicled so beautifully in the book Across the Sabbath River. Tell us a little bit about the B'nai Menashe today.
Well, the B'nai Menashe are a group of Jews and Judaizers. You have to distinguish, because Judaizers are people who are trying to live like Jews but haven't really undergone a formal Jewish conversion. And there are about 5,000 B'nai Menashe living in Israel as Jews, and about 5,000 more living in India as what I would call Judaizers, although their lives are really those of observant Jews. They live in northeast India, and right along the border with Burma, in the two small Indian states of Mizoram and Manipur. And they represent a fantastic historical story.
How did you first become acquainted with them?
I first became acquainted with them in 1998 when I read about an Israeli rabbi whose name was Eliyahu Avichayil, who was what one might call a lost tribe hunter. He was fascinated by the legend of the 10 lost tribes who disappeared after the Assyrian conquest of the land, northern land of Israel in the 8th century BCE. And lost tribe hunting has been a rather fruitless profession over the centuries, and he was one of its last practitioners because basically historians and scholars have all decided long ago that the lost tribes never, you know, don't exist and probably right. never did, and there's no point in looking for them. So I read about this rabbi who was going on a trip, one of his many trips to look for lost tribes. He was going in this case to China and northeast India and Thailand. And I asked if I could come along, and he said yes, and I got a contract to write it. It was originally a magazine article for it, and that's how it all started.
We will talk much more with Hillel Halkan about the B'nai Menashe, the Jews of India, as well as his extraordinary literary output when we come back here on Too Jewish in just a moment. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, 100,000 downloads of our podcast. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, you've traveled everywhere. I've traveled a fair amount, and I always go to the Jewish places wherever I am. And I have to say, I've been in places where the Jewish heritage travel is, this is where Jews used to live, this is where the synagogue used to be, or this is the synagogue that's now a museum, and there's no living Jewish life, ostensibly. And then you go somewhere else where there's dynamic Jewish life and there's history. You know, it's funny, traveling in Spain, you often feel like you're looking at a graveyard for Jews. Even though there is some active life, there's other places where there still is a Jewish community, and maybe, you know, what's your take on going to a Jewish place where there aren't Jews anymore, as opposed to going to a place where there is a vital Jewish life?
Well, it's a timely question because I'm just beginning a project of drawing up a list of Jewish heritage destinations for the rabbi of my childhood synagogue in St. Louis, who recently led a tour for his congregants to Morocco, and demand was greater than supply of places, so he can do that trip again and again, but he'd also like to branch out to other areas. And it turns out, as so many questions about Jewish existence, Jewish past, the Jewish universe, it's not an easy question, and there's not a straightforward answer. There's kind of three categories of places. One is a category like Istanbul or Thessaloniki, where there's a very rich Jewish past, and there were dozens, if not hundreds, of synagogues and huge numbers of Jews. And today, there is a living Jewish community several functioning synagogues and Jewish institutions, but shadow of its former self. Nonetheless, in those cities, you can connect with faculty of the Jewish day school.
You can go
or,
to the synagogue for services.
Right.
Can, there's a Jewish community center. There's stuff going on.
Right. And you don't have to depend on essentially an outside organization like Chabad to provide you with kosher meals or the possibility of attending a minyan if you have to say Kaddish. You can still rely on the communities.
The native communities, I would say.
Right. Then there's another category of places like Lviv or Vilna, which were huge in the Jewish past, centers of Jewish populations in the neighborhood of 250,000, and centers of great Jewish learning and scholarship, and now very much reduced in scope and in size. And you could go to those cities now and think that all that's left is monuments to the past. But if you dig a little deeper, you'll find that the World Jewish Congress or the Joint Distribution Committee or Chabad or all three have groups of teenagers who gather for Kabbalat Shabbat, and that there is Jewish life that you have to scratch beneath the surface to find. And then there's the third category, which is the most difficult and the saddest, where it seems like virtually all Jewish life is in the past. But even there, there's hopeful signs. Like both in Morocco and in Egypt, recently the governments are spending huge amounts of money restoring old synagogues, not so much for the few Jews who are left, and there are small Jewish communities there still,
right,
but for the Jewish tourists who come and who represent not the majority of tourism by any means, but an important source of tourist dollars or euros, as the case may be. So, yeah, it may be self-interested, but the local governments are actually restoring Jewish sites. Syria is an interesting example because I was there at a less disordered time, and I visited Jewish sites worth seeing in Damascus and Aleppo. But after all these years of civil war, who knows if there's even
anything left?
Shards.
Right, right. There was an interesting article recently in Smithsonian about recreating some of those synagogues in virtual touring, which is one more way you might touch a little bit of that past. Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This joke from my friend, the stand-up comedian Rabbi Bob Alper. After 6 years at his congregation, it's time for the rabbi to move on. He's taken a position in a different synagogue, and the members of his shul are upset with him. The rabbi says to the guy who is most angry, "Look, I really appreciate what you're feeling, but they will send you a new rabbi, and believe me, the next rabbi will do a better job than I've done." And the man says, "I don't know, rabbi. That's what they told us the last time." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing our world, and how long should it take? This week's portion of Ki Tavo gives us powerful commandments about how we are supposed to live in society. We're commanded to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, the widow, and the stranger. We are supposed to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and the homeless. We are to create a society of ethical practice and moral concern. We are to understand that a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. We are told repeatedly that God knows and expects us to live to this covenant, uphold it, cherish it, make it our own. And we are told of the blessings that will be ours if we can do this, and the curses we will bring on ourselves if we cannot do so. This covenant was large and challenging. It put real responsibilities on its members, its B'nai B'rit, to do things that weren't either easy or obvious, even if they were right. No doubt our ancient Israelite ancestors sometimes struggled when told to open your hands to the poor and needy, to welcome the stranger and immigrant, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Probably they didn't always manage to give their full tithes to make the pilgrimage to the temple to declare gratitude for what they had. I'll bet there were times they didn't provide adequately for the widow or the orphan. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live to this standard, nonetheless made them better people, made Jewish society egalitarian and generally ethical. And when they failed, they learned that what God wanted was tshuva, return to the right course. Positive societal change was never instantaneous. It was evolutionary. But it did happen for our ancestors and was codified as a practical framework by the rabbis of the Talmud. These standards should have at least as much meaning for us today. After years of verbal attacks, policy changes, and government persecution directed at some of the weakest members of society, immigrants, people seeking asylum, young children, we have a responsibility as Jews and as decent human beings to work to change this. When something isn't right, it's our responsibility to speak up and seek change. That's what the Torah teaches us in Ki Tavo, and what God has always required of us. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Hillel Halkin, the renowned translator, author, and general man of all letters, will discuss the Jews of northeastern India, the B'nai Menashe, and much more. Hear all about it from him when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo addressed the Republican National Convention last week from his balcony at the David Citadel Hotel in Jerusalem, the first time a U.S. National Political Convention has been addressed from Israel. That speech raised ethics concerns in the U.S. since U.S. diplomats are legally precluded from involvement in political activities, especially when they are on official business. But aside from the politics of the whole thing, the video reminded me that I got to stay in a similar room at the David Citadel Hotel once on a rabbinic mission trip. And besides the room being amazing, the view of the Jaffa Gate and even the Temple Mount from there are quite spectacular. They were rivaled only by the view from the King David Hotel balcony room we once had on a Cantor's Assembly trip many years ago. Also an opulent room, by the way. The foreign minister of Egypt stayed down the hall in an even better room, I suspect, with lots of guards. Or perhaps the view from the balcony of the Inbal Hotel I had once as well. That one when I led a synagogue trip to Israel. Those tour companies have amazing rooms with phenomenal views of the old city of Jerusalem. You just either have to be U.S. Secretary of State or head of some other state, or know somebody at a tour company when you bring them business in order to get them. I guess for me, the news was that Mike Pompeo had a really snazzy room in Jerusalem. Okay, in real news, I guess, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu announced last week that he had accepted a proposal to extend budget negotiations, preventing the government from collapsing and plunging the country into yet another new election. In a nationally televised address, Netanyahu said that now was not the time to drag the country into a fourth parliamentary election for Knesset in less than 2 years. Now is the time for unity, not elections, he said. Netanyahu and his rival and coalition partner Benny Gantz faced a deadline to agree on a budget. Otherwise, the government would have collapsed and automatically triggered a new election. Netanyahu said that following the historic agreement to establish official relations with the United Arab Emirates, and with Israel struggling with the coronavirus outbreak and economic crisis, he felt it was the wrong time to hold more elections. As though with the pandemic hospitalizing and killing people, Hamas sending incendiary balloons from Gaza, Hezbollah poised to retaliate for the Israeli assassination of one of their highest terror operatives, Israel needed the source of yet another election on top of it all. Anyway, Netanyahu accepted a compromise that would give the sides an additional 100 days to reach a budget deal, basically kicking the can down the road. In the meantime, direct some spending to areas of the economy that are struggling. After three deadlocked elections, Netanyahu and Gantz reached a power-sharing agreement in April, of course, to form this government to address the virus crisis. As part of their coalition deal, Netanyahu's Likud party and Gantz's Kahol V'Lavan agreed to pass a two-year budget, but Netanyahu insisted on passing a budget to cover only 2020, saying it would provide immediate assistance to the economy. Gantz is adamant the government honor its agreement and pass one for 2020 and 2021. Their disagreement again brought the country to the brink of meltdown. Pushing back the deadline, while it only delays things, the two parties are at loggerheads over a number of issues, judicial appointments, the annexation of the West Bank, and so on, and the government has been beset by infighting. Gantz has also complained that Netanyahu left him and Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi in the dark about the deal announced earlier this week to normalize relations with the UAE. If the budget deadline is not deferred and new elections are triggered, the country would have more political chaos. Netanyahu is currently charged with fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in three separate cases. His criminal trial began in June. But as prime minister, he refused to step down from office, denies any wrongdoing. Netanyahu has faced intense criticism over his government's handling of the coronavirus cases. Israel now has 100,000 confirmed coronavirus cases, more than 800 deaths. Unemployment there remains over 20%. Last weekend, 10,000 people took part in a weekly protest against Netanyahu's reign outside the prime minister's official residence in Jerusalem, calling on him to resign. Nonetheless, recent polls show Netanyahu would score a big victory if he held snap elections. By dissolving the government, he would avoid giving Gantz the premiership in November 2021, as required by the coalition agreement, which we here on Too Jewish never believed Bibi would honor. Pretty sure we'll be right on this one. You can make bank on it. Netanyahu appears determined to remain prime minister and therefore not legally obligated to resign while under indictment through the duration of his trial, which may last several years. In other news in Europe, Hungary's foreign minister summoned the German ambassador to explain remarks by his country's European Union minister accusing Hungary of anti-Semitism. Oh, I'm shocked. Hungarian Foreign Minister Pétis Zsártó rejected accusations, but he did not specify where the comments by this Minister of State for Europe, Michael Roth of Germany, were published. Spokesman said Zsártó was referring to an interview published online in which Roth criticized both Hungary and Poland for an erosion of democratic culture and also said one aspect that led to the Article 7 case against Hungary was rampant anti-Semitism in Hungary. The European Union invoked Article 7 of its governing treaty against Hungary back in 2018, having invoked the procedure for the first time against Poland in 2017 for flouting the rule of law. The process could lead to the suspension of their EU voting rights if all the other European capitals agree. In the past few years, Hungary's nationalist Prime Minister Viktor Orban, in power since 2010, has also angered the EU with harsh anti-immigration stance and a 2017 campaign against U.S. financier George Soros, which had very anti-Semitic undertones. Orban himself has publicly pledged zero tolerance for anti-Semitism, but he has many allies on the Hungarian right who are quite virulently and publicly anti-Semitic. Zsártó said that the Jewish community is safe in Hungary, shrugging off Roth's remarks, calling on him to stop the unworthy attacks on the Hungarian people. I suspect the EU will not stop resisting Orban's attempts to use anti-Semitic dog whistles as he continues to dominate Hungary's political scene. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish this morning our extraordinary guest. Hillel Halkin is a remarkable scholar, author, translator, has won the National Jewish Book Award, I think only twice, is that correct?
I've lost count, but I think it was twice.
Okay, sounds good. We're began speaking about the B'nai Menashe, the Jews of northern India, whom he chronicled so beautifully in his book Across the Sabbath River. The B'nai Menashe were sort of finally accepted as Jews in Israel not terribly long ago. Can you talk about that process and their kind of predicament right now?
Well, they didn't really have a great struggle being accepted in Israel. Their history, because they were adopted at a very early stage by an Orthodox rabbi, the same Rabbi Avichai, whom I mentioned previously. The whole B'nai Menashe movement is really very recent. It starts in the mid-1970s when small groups of Christians who had ancestors who had a pre-Christian shamanistic religion that was and were Christianized by British missionaries in the early 20th century, this small group of people who had come from mainstream Christianity to Messianic or Pentecostal Christianity, then moved on to Judaism and began trying, and they really, the boondocks of northeast India, it's about as far from anything as you can imagine, and in the middle of the jungle almost, and the small groups of people back in the 1970s, early 80s, began trying to live the lives of Jews. At first, they really didn't know what Judaism was, so that they depended on the Old Testament and bits and snatches of what they heard about Jewish practice. And then in the middle 80s, they were discovered by an Israeli rabbi, this Rabbi Avichail, who was a very interesting character. I knew him well. And he really brought Orthodox Judaism to them, and which they were very, very anxious to learn and adopt. And in the early 90s, he began bringing groups of them to Israel. But because they had his imprimatur, and he had very strong connections in the rabbinate, their commitment to Judaism was really never questioned in Israel. They did have to undergo a process of formal conversion, and they did that. And all of those who came, there are now 5,000 of them living in Israel as converted Jews and full Israeli citizens. But they didn't really have to overcome great opposition in Israel in order to do that.
Not in the same way that, say, the Ethiopian Jews or the Jews of the former Soviet Union have struggled. The B'nai Menashe that remain in India, they didn't all come, obviously, at once.
They would all like to come, I think, almost to a man and a woman and child. But at the moment, for largely bureaucratic and partly financial reasons, their aliyah is being held up. The last group came in 2 years ago, and since then none have arrived.
So they're in the midst of this coronavirus worldwide pandemic. I'm sure things are not good for them there.
No, the incidence of illness hasn't been terribly high yet in their area in India, although it of course could get worse. But as people are everywhere, they've been thrown out of work, lost their jobs, and because it's a community that lives on a subsistence level to begin with, and that people there have very, very little in the way of financial reserves, when you lose your job, you're in bad trouble.
Indeed. True everywhere, but more so in a place where the financial situation is very precarious.
Yeah, people there live hand to mouth. You know, every day they bring home a daily wage, and that gets them through that day.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk some about your literary, your extraordinary literary output. You know, I had the privilege when I lived in Israel of studying with my teacher, Lo Shalom, Ted Carmi, who was a translator who...
Really? You know that Ted Carmi?
I knew him well, yes.
Really? When we first came to Israel in the 1970s and we lived in Jerusalem, my wife and I, for a few years, and we got to be quite friendly with Carmi.
He was an extraordinary guy. I might tell a story about him, but also a famous translator, translated Shakespeare into English, as well as, of course, a number of other great works. You yourself have translated almost everybody. Yosef Chaim Brenner, Leah Goldberg, almost
all. No, actually, Goldberg not.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
But I have translated many authors.
I take her back.
Classic. Yeah.
Agnon too, if I'm not mistaken.
Agnon, yes, I've translated quite a bit of Agnon.
Tell us, what's the greatest challenge? And I know there are many in taking something written in one language and bringing it into modern Hebrew.
into modern English. I mean, you mean taking modern Hebrew
and modern Hebrew and bringing it into modern English.
Yeah,
sorry.
Into modern English. Well, as you said, there are many challenges, but I think the greatest is perhaps simply finding an English idiom which is both natural and flows in English and does not sound stilted or artificial, and is in the same way true to what's unique about Hebrew. With some Hebrew authors who, you know, really write a very contemporary Hebrew, that's not at all difficult. With others, like Agnon, whom you mentioned, who was, you know, the one Hebrew Literature Nobel Prize winner and is really the greatest of all modern Hebrew novelists and writers of fiction, it's a very big problem, because Agnon writes a language, Hebrew, which is very, very steeped in rabbinic tradition and rabbinic language, with constant allusions.
Deeply midrashic, really, in quality.
Right. And there, it's very, very difficult to find the right English style to convey him. A lot of people, I think, have failed because they've in a way tried to do more than is possible. And I think with a writer like Agnon, you have to, as a translator, know what you can do and what you can't do, and just concentrate on what you can do.
When you were you approached to do these translations? Do you decide? How does it work?
Generally, I've been approached by publishers to do translations. Very rarely by private individuals. And sometimes, in the case of publishers who I've worked with and I know well, I've suggested translations, but usually it's the publisher who comes to me.
Do you ever feel fully satisfied with the translation?
I sometimes think so at the moment, and I finished it, but then when I look at it, after it's come out as a book a year or two later, I always spot something which I say, gee, I could have done this better, or why didn't I think of this at the time when I could have done it? You always find, you second guess what you've done, but basically I think I've been pretty satisfied with what I do, because I'm a very, very careful and meticulous translator, and I do many, many drafts of every serious translation that I've done. So that by the time I'm finished working on it, really, I've thought about every word and every punctuation mark.
I want to ask about some of your original work. In addition to Across the Sabbath River, which we've spoken about the lost, so-called lost tribe, you wrote a beautiful biography of Yehuda Halevi, one of my all-time favorites, but also about Jabotinsky. Those are extraordinary choices. How did you come to write about those two particular individuals?
In the case of the Yehuda Halevi, both of those books were written for series, biographical series of historical Jewish figures. One was put out by Yale University Press, that was the Jabotinsky, and the other was put out by Shokin Books, and that was the Yehuda Halevi. In the case of Yehuda Halevi, Jonathan Rosen, who was at the time the editing the Shokin series, simply came to me and he said, Hillel, pick a Jew. And I thought very hard and long, but in the end I decided on Halevi, that he really was always a figure that I had loved. And as a translator also, it would be a great challenge, because I knew I would have to translate a great deal of his poetry. So that's how that happened. In the case of the Jabotinsky, which was a Yale University publication, I had written a book. Jabotinsky, who was a wonderful writer, and I mean, he's known mostly as a Zionist politician, but he was a
very
wonderful writer,
point.
And he
still influential politician today, I would say.
Yeah, I think so. And he wrote a great novel called The Five, which is set in Odessa in the early 20th century, and I wrote a review of it that was published in the New Republic of Blessed Memory.
Yeah.
And the editors of the series came across the review and were impressed by it, I guess, and asked me if I would do a biography of Jabotinsky, and I was very happy to do it. And I must say, if I may add a word here, that I was very lucky with both Yehuda Halevi and Jabotinsky, because in the case of many, perhaps even most great figures, so-called great figures, the better you get to know them, the less you think of them, the less you admire them.
Yeah.
And in the case of Halevi and Jabotinsky, it was just the opposite. The more I got to know about them and their lives and their work and their got into their minds, just the more I came to admire and even love them. And it was a wonderful experience to write about both of them.
You won the National Book Award, I think, for Letters to an American Jewish Friend, a Zionist poem.
That was my first book, yeah.
Yeah, your very first book. If you were to write that today, what would you say?
Well, I don't really think I would say anything very different, but I'm not sure I could write it or would even bother to write it. You know, the book, which was basically a plea for Aliyah or a demand for the Aliyah, I mean, it was basically a book that I, who had been in Israel perhaps all of 5 years when I wrote it back in the 1970s, I wrote it in the form of an imaginary exchange of letters with an American Jewish friend.
An epistolary nonfiction or fiction.
And basically I said in these letters, which were argued back and forth, I said, look, you know, whether you want to be a serious Jew or not is your own business. But if you're going to live, be a serious Jew, the place to be it is in Israel. At the time, back in the 70s, to my surprise, the book actually created certain waves in the American Jewish community, and I had, I think at the time, certain false hopes that perhaps it could be one of many things that would put the whole subject of Aliyah on the agenda of American Jews. But it never did, of course. American Jewry to this point really doesn't want to think about Aliyah, or even less than ever because, of course, the situation in Israel today. And in that sense, I'm not sure I would have the motivation to write such a book today. But I haven't changed any of the opinions on it.
That's good to hear. People change their minds so frequently in this world.
Yeah. No, I think I was right in 1970, and I think that book stands up well today.
So I have to tell a quick Ted Carmi story. I was a student of Ted Carmi's. And he was teaching Sifru, Jewish literature, poetry, and prose. And in a pretty large class, we had to go around and do our translations of whatever text had been assigned. And no matter what I said, I was always wrong. So we would, you know, it would be the word to be translated, I would say hall, and he would go, lo. And I'd say, vestibule. And he'd say, no, no. And whatever I did for weeks, several weeks was wrong. Finally, I went up to him afterwards and I said, Mark Carmi, you know, have I offended you in some way? And he said, no. I said, so why is everything I say wrong? And he looked at me and he said, you know more, so I expect more. And after that, we were okay.
He was a lovely person, Ted Carmi.
After that, we got along great. But His work of translation was really, in addition to his own creative work and his anthologies, was really pioneering. Do you rely on anybody else when you approach a text?
As a translator?
Yes. Yes.
No, not really. When I entered, I mean, today there are quite a few good Hebrew English translators around. But when I entered the field back in the 1960s, there were almost none. I mean, there was very little demand for the translation of Hebrew literature at the time, and there were very few people trying to do it, so that I really had a wide open field. But no, I think as a translator, I was really self-taught. I never took a translation course. I never much talked with other translators about translation. I just learned to do it, and that took me a long time to learn. I don't think I was a terribly good translator in those first years, but I became better and better.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. I hope we can get you back again. I want to thank Hillel Halkin for a terrific visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you?
Oh, they would have to read my books, I think, or... because I'm not on...
you don't have your own website.
Social media, I don't have a website. I think there is a Wikipedia article on me, but I don't know what's in it. But I do have in about a year or so, I'm going to have a collection of my essays from all down the years coming out, and that might be a good place to start reading my, you know, finding out about me.
It's a great introduction. I think I first became acquainted with you in articles in New Republic and then got to know your translations and some of your original works.
So, right.
Thank you again. We greatly appreciate
it. You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from the upcoming High Holy Days, now a little less than 3 weeks away. It's Leonard Cohen's fascinating and beautiful reinterpretation of a text from the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur liturgy in the Unetanet Tokef section, Who by Fire. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Sina Kahan, author of the fascinating new commentary book, Ideas, Bereishit. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
And who by fire? Who by water? Who in the sunshine? Slow decay, and who shall I say is calling? And who in her lonely slip, who by barbiturate, who in his rounds of love, who by something blown? By avalanche, who by powder, who for his grief, who for his hunger, and who shall I say is calling?
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.